Greetings, blenders, and welcome to Real Blend, a podcast with three co-hosts and yet only two Jason Momoa selfies. It is Tuesday, and that means it's show day.
Permission to take a selfie.
And that means we are live on Cinema Blend's Facebook page. So if you happen to be watching the stream over there, please drop us a comment, and producer Gabe will send it over to us. So let me get the introductions for this week's show out of the way. My name is Sean O'Connell, of course, the managing director at Cinema Blend, and one of three illustrious co-hosts of the weekly Real Blend podcast. And it brings me tremendous pleasure to also turn the microphone over to Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Kevin, hello.
Sean, how are you, sir? Jacob, how are you, sir? By the way, I don't know if we've ever said this on our show, but I think we need to mention this because this is a very important detail that I think we have just kind of kept under the radar.
What?
Jake's first two names in his name are based around Twilight. I think his mom knew Twilight was coming out, so his first name is Jacob, and his middle name is Edward, and that's an actual legitimate thing.
Oh,
is that right, Jake?
Bella. I thought his middle name was Bella.
Yeah, that's accurate. And seeing as Twilight is the only film series for which I did every single junket, I got so desperate for questions by the end of that series that I started doing a bit about my own name and how there should be a team Jacob Edward. That's how you know you are at the bottom. Not only are you at the bottom of the barrel, you've dug through the bottom of the barrel, and now you're digging into the ground trying to find questions.
If you actually secretly walk through Jake's house, Twilight is bed sheets, his pillows. He's the biggest Twilight fan you'll ever meet.
My biggest concern is, why would you be secretly walking through my house?
If anybody sees your house.
That is Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Official introduction. Jake, how are you, sir?
Jonathan, damn good to see you, sir.
Good to see you also. We got a lot to get to this week, obviously. This is episode number 47. We are working our way towards episode number 50. As we get into the heart of December, it's ridiculous that this year, the summer blockbuster season, has broken off a piece of itself and moved into December, because it feels like we have a million blockbusters coming, and then just junk it, like an insane amount of junkets. If you guys have been listening to the show on the regular, you know that the three of us typically travel to press events, most of the time in New York and Los Angeles. We've been able to sort of run into each other at events for Aquaman. Kevin was talking about the fact that last weekend he did, Kevin, what did you say? You did to LA, to New York, to LA, back to the East Coast?
It was insane. Yeah, Thursday night I flew to L.A. and then Friday morning I did Spider-Man and Mowgli in L.A. and that was Christian Bale and Shameik Moore. And then I flew back to New York Friday night, landed at 1:30 in the morning. And Saturday I did Mary Poppins and If Beale Street Could Talk. Sunday I did Aquaman and Ben Is Back, then flew back to L.A. Sunday night and then did Deadpool yesterday and Bird Box, and then flew home last night, and now I'm with you guys.
Insane.
From D.C.
How do you not get upgraded more often? I do not understand how you fly this much and don't get upgrades.
Zero upgrade on any of those flights.
That blows my mind. Well, I fly less than you and I get upgraded.
The reason is because, I fly like 150,000 miles a year, but the D.C. to L.A. route is probably one of the most popular routes in the country, I would assume, and same with New York. So, yeah, I mean, I always
tell them who you are.
No, but
you are the co-host of Real Blend.
No, I mean,
just say that as you're walking onto the plane and then just drop your crap on the first class seat that you see.
And then they throw me in a middle seat in row 40 if it happens if I say that.
Next to some guy who was passing extreme gas.
That would be Kevin.
By the way, I have a special place in my heart.
Gabe is already losing it. We are already so off the
rails. No, he likes this. This is good material.
But people that pass gas on airplanes, you know, I will say they're... I'm being serious about this for a second.
This is a good topic.
No, I'm being serious about this. Here, it's such a stealthy move, and I honestly don't get mad. I'm kind of impressed that people pull it off because you don't know who it is. I'm being serious.
Right.
Like, I look around and I look for people's facial expressions changing and...
There's a special circle of hell for people that fart on an airplane.
But Jake, I mean, we fly as much as we fly.
Okay, we have to move on. We really have to move on past this topic.
To keep us brief, does it happen a lot to you on the plane, Jake?
Not
it happens
really.
To me all the time. No. I don't know why. Is it me? Is it me that I'm...
Is it you that's actually doing it?
No! Is it me that just... The people... I don't know. I have no idea.
You're getting such a hard rap from Game
Brothers. We are going to move to news because we have so much to get to this episode. We're going to play a round of Rising and Falling. We're going to have an update on the AFI, release their top 10 list. It's going to get us to talk about a couple of the movies that we've been able to catch up on the past couple of weeks, movies that are in the Oscar contention. We are going to have a spoiler-free review of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Before we get to news, I have to give a quick shout-out to our London fans who got together and did a little meet and greet without us, which I think is awesome. That's so phenomenal.
Yeah, they didn't even invite us.
No, we're not even part of the
equation. Not even
like
a, hey, are you maybe going to be in London?
Nope. Nothing. And in fact, there was someone who wasn't at the first meet and greet, so it's almost like it's growing. we're not even part of it anymore. So if you guys find a way to get together in your own markets because you all happen to be fans of Real Blend, please send us pictures and we will continue to share that on our social, much like we share reviews over on our iTunes page. We have 66 star ratings. We have 35 reviews. The latest came to us from Brendan Wagaman. I'm going to go that route. Brandon, who says, great for commute. Oh, this is really cool. I don't know if you guys read this yet. This is a podcast I typically listen to on my commute. I do about a 15-minute to and from commute to my work. A lot of times for podcasts, I typically just save it for the next ride to and from work. But this one, once I'm done with the commute, I stick my earphones in my ears and finish the podcast as I want to hear it all the way through to the end. Great podcast to listen to. So I think that's fantastic.
Thank you, Brandon.
That's awesome.
You're a good man. News. So last night... During Monday Night Football, this is Tuesday, we're recording this, the second trailer for Captain Marvel dropped. Obviously not the trailer that Marvel fans are waiting for. Everyone's sort of poised waiting for this Avengers 4 trailer to drop, and it's not here yet. So when that does drop, we're not going to be able to get together and record another podcast, unfortunately. But you guys jump on our Twitter feed, at Real Blend. Send us your reactions to the Avengers 4 trailer once it finally does drop. We'll react to it on social. We'll interact with you guys there, and of course we'll talk about it on next week's show. But what do you guys think about the Captain Marvel trailer? Is it getting you excited for the March 2019 debut of Brie Larson's hero?
Meh.
No, it's not doing it yet.
No, honestly, I love Brie Larson. I think she's a fantastic actress. Obviously has an Oscar under her belt, so what do I know about acting? But I really hope it's because some of the lines were taken out of context and you need to see them in the scene. But in the trailer, the delivery of some of her lines, I just thought was so flat.
Really?
And it so conflicted with the action that we were seeing on camera. I felt like I was listening to someone act. Someone pretend to be a stupid. Someone reading words off of a sheet of paper. Honestly, I sometimes I watch those trailers and I think, oh, cool, I want to see it. And then I have to actually catch myself and go, okay, do I want to see it because I just know I need to see it because it's part of the MCU? Or does that trailer actually look good? Mm. And I think it's the former for me. I think I just want to see it because I know I need to see it and I know it's the precursor to Avengers 4. I don't want to see it because the trailer made me want to see it.
That's an interesting point. And I actually, it's fascinating you say that because the new trailer for Captain Marvel didn't impress me anywhere near as much as the first one did.
Yeah. Agreed. Agreed 100%.
Yep. And the first one was great. And listen, and we all know this, a trailer can be unbelievably awesome and then the movie could be absolutely awful, and then vice versa. So, I think that this new trailer was just passable. It didn't like blow me away. I did like the last sequence where it almost had an Iron Man feel to what she was doing at the end of that trailer. And then I think the cat thing was funny with Nick Fury. I thought that was kind of cool. I don't know. I like little random things like that. But yeah, listen, I think Brie Larson, I think she's a great choice for Captain Marvel. We can sit here all day and debate about how the trailer is going to imply how well the movie's going to be. But we all know Marvel's brilliant at misdirecting and the way, and, you know. So, you know, I don't put a ton of faith into a trailer and how the outcome of the film will end up being. Ready Player One was a great example. The first couple trailers for that movie weren't amazing. And then that final one with Take On Me was amazing. And then the movie was clearly amazing. So, yeah, I mean, I'm with Jake. I think the trailer didn't do much for me this time around. Had some cool stuff. But yeah, the first one, the blockbuster scene in the first one was so cool. That to me spoke to the 90s. Nothing in this trailer really felt 90s to me.
Well, and truthfully,
yeah.
I'll just say Marvel at this point could do 4 or 5 bombs in a row, and I'd still give them the benefit of the doubt. Like, yeah, we're 20 films into this thing. They haven't had a flat-out stinker. There might be some where you're just like, it wasn't quite as good as some of the other ones, but it's still entertaining. And if Captain Marvel happens to be that, which I don't even think it's going to be. I think their quality control is so tuned in that they won't let a mediocre film sort of slip through the cracks. They're on top of every aspect of that film. But I do agree with you guys that I haven't yet seen a moment in those trailers, and especially you guys are exactly right. The first trailer cut is better than the second trailer cut. It felt like it had more of an emotional impact than this one.
Yeah. That first time that her became hero in that first trailer was such a gut punch, like, oh my God. And using it again this time sort of felt like, hey guys, remember when we did it the first time? Wasn't that really cool? Like, here it is again.
Well, and truthfully, once it hits, I mean, Avengers 4 is right behind it, and it's just going to decimate everything, you know? So, I don't know. We'll see.
Pardon my ADD, but when we get to the Clint Eastwood blend today, just remind me, that I said, remind Kevin about the connection to the mule. Just remember that. I'm not making a joke, Gabe. I don't want to forget because I don't have a pen.
Gabe, write that down.
I said that. Yeah, remind me.
I didn't even mention the fact that this week's blend game is Eastwood Blend, and people have been playing along on social, and I absolutely appreciate that. And later in the show, we are going to play.
Good reaction on social.
Hashtag Eastwood Blend. And do we mention now that the three of us have found out now that we're lucky enough to get Clint? We're all going out to Los Angeles this weekend to interview Clint for The Mule. So super
excited
about that.
My first time, Sean, you've gotten him before, and Kevin, you've gotten him before.
Yeah, this is my fourth time. This is like, this is kind of crazy. I'll tell a very 30-second quick story about Clint Eastwood. I was in the hallway waiting to do the interviews for the movie Sully, and Tom Hanks's room was unoccupied at the moment because he was waiting to get there to do his interviews. Clint Eastwood comes downstairs to do some quick promos for IMAX for Sully in another room, and he's walking down the hallway. And one of the people at Warner Bros. Was cool enough to go, hey, do you want to pop into Hanks's room for a second and do a couple quick interviews with some journalists? So I literally just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And I was one of the two people who got thrown into that room, which was Tom Hanks's interview room, while he wasn't there yet, to interview Clint Eastwood. And during that interview, Eastwood just ate peanuts the entire time.
It's a great
time.
Video. It's worth YouTubing. And he's giving great answers. It's not like he's being disrespectful or mean, but he's just munching on peanuts. But to me, I thought it's cool because you look like two guys hanging out just talking chilling. Film while one of them just happens to be eating peanuts.
Wait, Jake, I wish I asked him for a peanut to chew on it while I was talking to him. That's the only thing I wish I had done.
Jake and I got Momoa at the Aquaman junket on a different day than Kevin did. So Kevin, this might not be an issue for yours, but Jake, did anybody comment on the fact that he was chewing gum the whole time?
I didn't notice he was chewing. I don't think he was chewing gum during my
interview. Oh, okay. So find mine. It's on Cinema Blend's YouTube page, and he's chewing gum the entire time. And there's like people making comments underneath, and they're like, extreme teacher voice, Mr. Momoa, if you didn't bring enough gum for the whole class, please.
And I also know someone else. Did you get him? This is such a weird question. Did you get him hair down or hair up? Because I know people later in the day, like he'd like put his hair up in a like a ponytail.
Hair down.
And people were
hair down,
like,
but he had a pink scrunchie around his wrist.
Me
and
too.
And people pointed that out.
I was, as weird as it sounds, happy that I got him hair down because everything in Aquaman, that's how he looked. But I know some people that were upset later in the day that they got him hair up because they're like, oh, that's the whole look is to have his hair down and flowing.
That's pretty funny.
Mostly my big thing was it's about me. So I understand why they were so worried about how his hair looks.
The hair in Aquaman is all CGI, which blows my mind. Yeah, I cannot believe that. I thought maybe that they like... I thought maybe it was some of his hair being blown up with like a hair dryer or something like that because it's not really underwater. But wow, can you imagine being a CGI artist?
The first time I watched that movie, I just stared at Dolph Lundgren's hair the entire time. It's just swaying back and forth in the water. I mean, they can't shoot any of those scenes underwater. None of that shot underwater. It's just wire work.
Can we make our big announcement yet? Are we ready to do this? I don't know if people
have told us what
people
it is
yet.
First.
I'm curious as to what this announcement is.
No, this is huge. So in Aquaman, it's actually my body, with right. Jason Momoa's head on top of it. So when you watch Aquaman, that's literally my yep. body from neck down.
But he's only talking about the scenes that whenever Arthur Curry is in middle school. And that's the scenes that he's talking about. Beyond that, then it's actually Jason Momoa.
And in Vice, it's my body on Dick Cheney.
Right. So Bale didn't gain the weight.
Bale's face on my chin and body.
Oh my God. This is actually kind of crazy. So I was interviewing Christian Bale for Mowgli, and we were talking about performance capture that he does in Mowgli versus the weight he gained to play Dick Cheney. I don't know if you guys saw the clip I put on Twitter today, but Bale called Gary Oldman during the process of preparing for Dick Cheney. And he goes, "Hey, Gary, you know, what did you do to prepare to play Churchill?" And he goes, "Gary, I've already gained 20 pounds. Am I on the way there?" And Gary Oldman goes, "Wait, I didn't gain any weight for Churchill. What are you talking about?" And then Christian Bale's like, no, Gary, seriously, I'm at 20 pounds. How much did you actually gain?" He goes, "Christian, I didn't gain any weight at all. It's all prosthetics." And
well,
so Bale was
pretty well documented. Like, wasn't it very well documented that Gary Oldman
Bale didn't know that.
At no point in the conversation of Darkest Hour did I think that Gary Oldman gained weight.
But then why do we think that Bale gained weight?
Because he did.
But I mean, I don't know.
Part of me watching Vice thought he was using some sort of prosthetics. I cannot believe he put that weight on. I can't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, we're all over the place.
We are ADD episode.
It's okay. That's the point of the podcast. We can go off topic a little bit.
We can go off topic. Yes, I'm going to bring us back around to a film that I know Kevin wants to elaborate on.
Gabe is just throwing his headphones down and walking out of the room.
I want to bring up Bohemian Rhapsody for this reason. It's the movie that just won't go away. You know, we're waiting for these other movies to sort of come up and challenge what we think are the front runners. And one factor that we talk about often with films that can potentially contend for awards is box office. You have to potentially do well. If you're making $12 million, you know, total, there's a good chance that you're not going to get that much conversation. Bohemian Rhapsody is dominating at the box office. It just keeps packing it in. $164 million domestic. It's $540 million global. I'm past the point of believing that it's just Rami. I'm starting to believe that it could do better in other categories. I don't think Singer gets in for director necessarily, but this could easily.
No chance Singer gets in.
But in a 10 picture field, it's starting to feel like it could get there.
But I don't know what. I don't know, man. I still don't feel like there's enough love for it. And at the end of the day, there's got to be love for the movie. And a lot of people, everyone I talk to, universally agrees that Rami's fantastic, but I don't get enough people truly loving this movie. Though then again, every movie that's supposed to come out, that's supposed to be Oscar worthy, that's supposed to be great, has sort of been met with meh. That's why I still think A Star is Born is still such a big front runner, is because every movie that was supposed to challenge it is not doing great. And even something like Green Book has failed at the box office, to your point. So that hurts its chances a little bit.
We're going to get to the AFI in a second too, but you'll see the two of the titles that keep showing up as these bigger groups are releasing their year-end top tens. It's Black Panther and Quiet Place. They're like blockbusters that came out much earlier in the year, and they're lingering around because, like you said, people are looking at the slate of would-be Oscar contenders, and they're not necessarily in love with these pictures. So,
right. See, I'm actually getting the opposite of reaction that Jake's getting about Bohemian Rhapsody. I'm seeing undying love for this film.
No, are you okay? I'm talking about people within the industry who vote and have a voice. The average movie goer loved it. Like, I've had people come up to me on the streets. I have people come up to me at work. Yeah, you're absolutely right. But in terms of people that have a voting voice, I don't know enough that truly love Bohemian Rhapsody.
Okay, but wait, what if it does really well at the Globes on Thursday? We have Golden Globe nominations on Thursday.
I mean, so did The Tourist.
A musical comedy category.
But Bohemian Rhapsody is going for drama.
Oh, is it really? Why would it go in the musical category?
That's so going for drama. So is Star is Born.
Oh, that's stupid.
They just totally missed their chance. Everything's going to go to Mary Poppins now. They just totally missed their shot.
That's really stupid.
Well, see,
they missed their shot, dude.
Because we all know that I think at the end of the day, when it comes down to the Golden Globes, if you don't put you put Bohemian in musical because the Golden Globe drama category comes down to Star is Born and Roma, I think Roma's going to win it.
Roma can't win drama.
Why?
I don't think a foreign film can compete for best drama at the Golden Globes. Alfonso Cuarón can get director, but Roma cannot win Best Picture Drama. It can win Best Foreign Film, but cannot win Best Picture Drama. So Best Picture Drama will likely go to A Star Is Born, and then Rami Malek, who could have won Best Actor in Musical or Comedy, will now likely lose to probably Bradley Cooper in the category. And what, nominations come out on Thursday, and then I think probably Lin-Manuel Miranda maybe wins. Or no, maybe Christian Bale maybe wins for Vice.
Well, the reason
Vice
is
going for comedy.
The reason I say Roma wins is we just did it.
Vice is a comedy and Bohemian Rhapsody is a drama.
Yep.
Vice is a comedy at times.
It's funny, but
I think
terrifying.
Vice is a better. Yeah, I think Vice is a better fit in comedy than Bohemian. Though then again, it also depends on your definition of the word musical. Like, is a movie about music a musical? In the same tradition that Mary Poppins is.
Yeah, I see what you're
no,
saying.
No, I think Mary Poppins is a straight-up musical.
No, so Mary Poppins is a straight-up musical, but is Bohemian Rhapsody a musical?
No. It's an interesting question because, see, here there's two different things here that are happening. In the music that happens in Bohemian Rhapsody happens within actual concert footage and real practicing of musicians. In my opinion, a musical is when people belt out in music randomly, like out of nowhere, like a Greatest Showman or a Les Mis, it's an interesting.
So, Star Is Born doesn't fit
there.
Yeah, Star Is Born. But in terms of angling yourself for your best potential to win, forget what category you should be in.
Yeah.
Fox should have put Bohemian Rhapsody in musical or comedy, and it'd be done.
I thought you just screamed out the F word at us.
Me too. I actually heard the F word at first.
Like, why?
And then I heard
so
the
angry?
X come in. Yeah, but I will say this.
That's for our private text conversations.
In my opinion, I was having a conversation about this yesterday. In my opinion, there are three films right now that, in my opinion, are the complete front runners for Best Picture. One of these three is going to win. And either of them can win. I think it's Roma, Star Is Born, and Black Panther. And I think... So the critics group I belong to.
Not
here
Green Book.
No. I think Green Book will get nominated, but not win. I think that my critics group in DC, WAFCA, we actually awarded Roma Best Picture, and I believe Alfonso Cuarón Best Director. That's why I was starting to wonder if Roma was starting to gain that momentum, and I didn't know that it couldn't win at the HFPA and the Golden Globes. But I'm telling you right now, I mean, like, that's the thing. Like, Roma, while it's different from any film we've ever seen before, it still fits into a very Oscar-y type artistic box, even though it's different. I don't want to put Roma in an Oscar category, but it does feel more like an Oscar film than the other two. But Black Panther winning, as we've mentioned before, would be a big impact and open up the way Oscars are voted on. And then the second part is Star Is Born, which in my opinion, out of the three, is the better film overall. So I think either of those three can win. I am curious where each of you lie right now, as if you had to make your prediction at this moment, what would win?
Best Picture?
Yeah.
I would probably say A Star Is Born. Because here's the deal, is that we talk about that inevitable backlash that usually comes in January after the nominations come out. It happened with La La Land, it happened to Social Network.
Right.
But then the favoritism falls to usually that second movie that people are loving. And I don't feel like there's a strong enough second movie. Yes, a lot of people like Roma, but a lot of people like are on my, you know, even though not on this podcast, but I know a lot of people aren't as much on the Roma bandwagon, and their voices just aren't as loud because it doesn't make them seem as cool.
I think Roma's a much bigger threat than you think it is. I think I actually think Roma is one of the biggest threats to any film winning this year.
I think you're discounting the fact that a lot of older Academy members are not going to sit through that movie.
If The Artist won Best Picture, which was a black and white film that took you back to the pre-sound.
Yeah, but that was also a love letter to themselves. That was, aren't we so great? There's nothing about Roma that compliments itself.
All right, well, let me bring up this. Let's get to this. We're going to get to Rising and Falling. And I
wanna... Wait, Sean, real quick. What do you think wins? If you had to pick it today, what wins?
If I had to pick it today, I would say Star Is Born. But
I think so, yeah.
I think that is also the movie... In a way, I didn't want to believe with La La Land. It's the movie that people are just waiting for their chance to turn on. I think.
But have you noticed how Star Is Born is being handled? It has not become that film.
But that normally happens after nominations come out.
I don't know. I think La La Land hit this point in December. See, I think Star Is Born.
I think it really hit its point in January.
But I think Starsborn really hasn't done. Yeah,
I think in that second wave of after the nominations are out, that's when Roma has the chance to, and especially if Roma for whatever reason ends up leading in the number of nominations, like if it gets a lot of below the line because it's a technically wonderful film, if it turns around and says this is such a respected film and pushes that narrative, it could get ahead of Star Is Born. But I think it's one of those
what
two.
Technical nominations would Roma get that A Star Is Born wouldn't get? Because also A Star Is Born will get all the acting nominations.
Cinematography? I don't see Roma getting.
You don't think Star Is Born could get cinematography?
I think it's well shot, but is it like?
Yeah.
Is
okay.
It,
all right. I mean, Roma will definitely get a cinematography nomination. Okay.
I would even argue I would even argue that
dog
First
poop?
Man
is dog poop
first,
a category.
I think First Man would get in over in cinematography over.
No, that's fair. Okay, so cinematography is one, but I could see Star Is Born getting the sound mixing and sound editing nominations, and Roma not getting them.
Are we going to get Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga performing at the Oscars?
Yeah, they've already said they would. If that song gets nominated, they'll perform it.
Does Bradley come out in character?
No.
I mean, I can't imagine.
You're just singing.
No, I'm being serious. Like, did he go have
no,
a hat on?
I'm saying it's going to look a little bit strange if he's
strange.
Just Bradley Cooper.
Well, right. When they all came out for Les Mis, didn't they just come out in regular clothes? Like clothes, tuxedos?
But Cooper disappeared in that role. Like I can't imagine Bradley Cooper playing that song.
I think he's going into Oscar night thinking this could be the moment of his career. I doubt he's going to be worried about putting on a cowboy hat and whether his facial hair is the same. I think he's thinking, look, I'm giving you the performance. Isn't that good enough? Now let me get back to my seat so I can win.
I think
actor.
He should reenact the Grammy scene from Star Is Born and just go there and pee himself.
What he's accepting is award. Oh my God.
It would still be better than some of the performances that have occurred during the Oscars.
Could you imagine if Gaga got up there to win Best Actress and then Cooper went up on stage?
Stumbles up?
But in the way he would do it, like he would just kind of walk up there just to give her a hug. We would all go, what's going to happen? I can't believe that scene was like shocking. I couldn't believe that.
All right. I want to get to Rising and Falling this week. And I want to start it with the AFI who released what was the other group that we did already?
Ooh, I have a good falling.
By the way,
hold on for a second. What? But
real fast on that scene in Star Is Born. That's actually one of the most devastating scenes in the film for me, especially when a few people who've seen Star Is Born after that scene occurs, when Dice Clay has to carry him to the shower.
Yeah.
Like that scene made me, I just started weeping.
Well, because it's a great scene because you also understand that from the perspective of a father where you just ruined my daughter's moment.
Yes. And he's sitting there trying to help this guy, but he's also angry at him. And I think Dice is not getting enough credit for his performance.
I love
Dice. He is unbelievable.
Yeah, I get
that,
but
film.
I mean, honestly, I'd rather live in a world where Sam Elliott has an Oscar.
Oh, I agree. I just think that, I mean, you guys can all agree with me. Dice isn't being talked about at all. So
is he even listed on that? Like whenever we get these screeners, we talk about getting screeners. A lot of times on the back of them, it suggests some of the people and categories it would like to be nominated for. Under supporting actor, obviously it would have Sam Elliott, but did it have Dice on there?
I don't know.
But he's very understated, and that scene is amazing. It really
is. I want to pull back the curtain just a little bit. We have show notes that the other guys don't look at all, and in it we have all these great topics, and as the show continues, Gabe just scratches them all out.
Why can't we just go 10 minutes longer?
That's the beauty of the show. But the beauty of Gabe is that he scratches off all these fun things that we were going to talk about.
The beauty of Gabe is that face of his.
Yeah,
that's the beauty of Gabe. And that's how Jake just got 5 more minutes on the show.
He just doesn't want
I have a good falling. I have a good falling.
He doesn't want any topic to get Christian stale. That's all. We'll just move on.
Fair enough. The AFI did their 10 culturally and artistically significant films of 2018. I don't know why they can't just say the best films of 2018, but this is what it is according to the American Film Institute. And I want to read through them all and then we can sort of backtrack and sort of unpack. But in order, they put Black Klansman. I keep calling it Black
Klansman. Why do you call it Black K Klansman?
That's how it's.
No, it's Black Klansman, but it's because it's KKK in the middle.
You've been saying Black K Klansman
for like months. I don't understand.
It's not Sterling K. Brown. It's Black Klansman.
He turns to the camera and he goes, K is silent. That's what it is. Middle K is silent.
That's in my top 10 of the year.
Eighth Grade, If Beale Street Could Talk, The Favorite, First Reformed, keeps popping up on people's lists. Green Book, Mary Poppins Returns, Black Panther, A Quiet Place, and A Star is Born. Gabe wants us to note, Roma was not eligible for the main list, but was also recognized with an AFI Special Award for films outside of AFI's criteria for American film, according to the LA Times. A couple of titles I want to pull off of this list because they, like we mentioned earlier, they keep surfacing. And I think it's because as people putting their list together, they're like, all these November, December movies don't do anything for me. So we're going to keep looking back. So Eighth Grade, I love that Eighth Grade keeps showing up. That's on my top 10 so far. First Reformed keeps coming back. And then Black Panther and Quiet Place are movies that were released. And Black Landsman were released much earlier.
Sean, and I think you mentioned this, and I think you're absolutely right. First Reformed would be on my top 10 list if it were not for the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
Like, I was texting you guys as I was watching the movie, like, guys, like, this movie is a masterpiece. And then just the way it ends left me with such a, why did you have to end that way? That's not the,
I agree.
So frustrating.
But you got to judge the whole movie.
Yeah, I know.
And really,
I know,
a bad ending can torpedo a film absolutely. That has great. But Ethan Hawke seems to be getting a lot of attention, and
which I'm okay with.
Yeah, and First Reformed is being trumpeted a lot by the critics groups. Now, it strikes me as a movie that definitely could just do well with critics groups. But I don't know if that will help it necessarily in its Oscar race.
You know, Sean, on that list just now, you mentioned If Beale Street Can Talk, and I just had the opportunity to see that over the weekend before doing the interviews. I gotta say, that film blew my mind. Like, in the sense of the cinematography and Nicholas Brittle's score, who did the score for Moonlight. For any of our audience out there, when this film hits your market, it's a platform release, so it's opening on the 14th in some markets, and then it goes throughout Christmas. And I know Jake did the Q&A last night. It's so powerful, and it's so beautiful to look at in regards to shot choices. But I did not, and this might sound ignorant to me, it woke me up to something that I knew was an issue, but I didn't understand it fully until Barry spoke to me the way he did in this movie. Just this idea of what's happening to this character in this film. And I don't know, it just made me want to go out and do something to help. I mean, it's a very relevant film that takes place, I believe, in the early 70s. I believe is the timeline on that, or 60s. Or I can't remember the exact decade.
What is the time frame on it?
I think it's the early 70s.
The book was written in 74.
I think it's early 70s. Okay. Yeah. But I mean, it's unbelievable. And Kiki Layne, I wish she was getting more discussion around her performance because she's amazing.
Well, and so I want to, and Jake, hold on to your falling because I definitely do want to get that and remind me if I move off it because I don't want to move off it. But Regina King plays the mom of Kiki's character in the movie, right?
Yes.
And she is showing up at the top of anytime they're doing best supporting actresses by category, she's winning. And I loved Beale Street. Beale Street is in that 10 to 11 spot for me right now. It's when I keep moving into my list as I do my end of the year and it kind of keeps slipping off and I'm going to revisit it. I don't remember her having a performance that stands out to me. Like, how come she's across the board blanket being put at the top of a category like best actress, best supporting actress? Did you guys leave that movie saying like, her performance was unbelievable? The two leads to me were better.
I agree with you. No, I agree. And I think I went into the movie after buzz about Regina King had already started. So I was more looking for stuff, but I tried to picture if I didn't know any buzz about who was getting the most attention. Honestly, if I had to throw a nomination to someone, I would love, and I don't foresee it happening because I'm not sure he has enough screen time because he really only has one scene, Brian Tyree Henry.
That
moment where he talks about, without getting into it, essentially talks about what happens to someone in prison.
Yeah.
To me, that is the reason supporting actor, that category exists.
Yeah.
For someone that can come in and just have, I think literally the scene is 12 minutes. Have a 12-minute scene and have me walking out praising the movie, loving the movie, but going, my God, that 12-minute scene was unbelievable.
Yep. Well, the beauty of that scene, and we can be vague about it because we actually don't know what he's talking about specifically yet. And Jake talks about that scene specifically. It's the horror in Brian's eyes in that sequence.
His eyes change.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. His eyes, you could tell when he starts talking about prison.
Yeah.
Something like a, like something rolls over in his eyes and he just, he seems like a different person.
To give a, just a brief perspective, basically Stephen James's character runs into Brian on the street after not seeing him for a few years. And Brian Tyree Henry's character has gotten back from prison. And if I remember correctly, the reason he was in there was not at all what he should have been in there for the time frame he was in there. It was like, he explains that to Stefan. He was wrongfully put in there for the time period he was. I think he took a plea, I believe.
Well, and really fast too, just to sort of mention, because there's probably a lot of people listening to this who haven't had a chance to see Beale Street yet. The reason why it's significant is because by the time that we get to that performance in the movie, we already know that the lead character has been imprisoned for something that he's saying he didn't do. So a lot of this is filling in the gaps of, is he going to get a chance to prove his innocence and get out? And then in the course of that, the way that that story is told, I think it's beautifully structured. You get to a person who he knows who has been in prison. So the weight of the fact that he's in prison is weighing on all of us anyway. And then you meet this guy who is obviously affected by a prison's term.
Yeah, and it's not a spoiler. I mean, it's just the character is just telling his stories about his prison experience. And we're talking about Brian Tyree Henry's character specifically.
If you're unfamiliar with who Brian Tyree Henry, he plays Paperboy in Atlanta. He's an amazing actor.
But this scene specifically...
Great Widows, too.
Oh, Widows,
Jake is so right, though, that it's what he doesn't say is what scares me the most.
Yeah.
Because he never really goes into exact details of what he went through in prison. But I start picturing it and imagining the horrors of what happened to him. But
what he doesn't say is far more horrifying. Because what we imagine he's talking about is far more horrifying than if he had said, XYZ happened to me.
Yeah. That's why I always found, this is a strange connection to make, but that's why I always found 7 to be so brutal. Because in 7, you never really saw the acts take out. You just saw the aftermath and or an explanation of it.
Right.
Especially Lust. That's the one that always horrified me, just the explanation of what happened. So to me, the power of a filmmaker, if you can help us visualize what it is without actually explicitly showing it to us, you've done your job. And I think that's what Brian Tyree Henry does in that scene so well. But to answer Sean's question about Regina King, I think she's amazing in the film, and I think her sequences are incredible. But I would argue that, like Jake said, Brian Tyree Henry, in my opinion, had a stronger connection to me from the film. But also, I think Kiki and Stefan are not being talked about enough.
Right.
Like, I think they are just... I mean, if you talk to Barry Jenkins about how they shot those scenes across the window as they were on the phones in jail, they used this insane type of reflection cinematography that enabled them to actually talk through these phones but see each other through reflections. It's very well done.
Dude, this is the most pretentious thing in the world to say, but the glass that separates them at the prison is a character in the movie.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
It is a character in the movie. And every time they were across from each other in that scenario, I just felt the weight of it was like a villain. It was like an antagonist.
Yeah. I agree, dude. That was a super pretentious thing to say.
Right? I know.
No, I'm
God.
Joking. No, you're absolutely right. No, you're absolutely right, dude. Seriously.
Well, the scary part, I mean, Sean's 100% right. That glass is the film's subject.
Right.
That's what the film is about, is that separation for nothing. And the crazy thing about the glass is that they can see each other so clearly, but they can't touch each other.
Right.
And there are some scenes. Yeah, it is so powerful.
Which is why I'm glad M. Night Shyamalan's doing that spinoff in January, because I want to see what happened with that character later. Jake, you had a falling.
I do have a falling. And I never thought I would say this. Incredibles 2.
Ooh.
I think Incredibles, even though I have not seen
Spider-Man.
I know a lot of people that are putting it on their top 10 list. I know a lot of people that are calling it not just the best animated film of the year, but the best Spider-Man movie ever, one of the best superhero movies ever. I think Pixar, they were probably already starting to write down their Oscar speech, just paused and went, oh crap, we could lose this in the last moment.
Right. Well, when they looked at the landscape and saw the Grinch, right, and like no real competition, they're like, we got this in the bag.
We got this. Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to talk about Spider-Verse in a little bit. But
so wait, agree or, agree or disagree that Incredibles 2 is falling?
Oh, I agree. I think that's a really good choice. And it's so funny that like Pixar is the layup in that category every single year, you know, nothing really gives it a run. But the animation in Into the Spider-Verse, is incredible, and we can elaborate that when we get to that segment. I want to run real fast through a segment that we're doing on the show each week, just called This Week in Movies. We're in a real sort of limbo for the past 2 weeks because there haven't been major things coming, and then for the rest of December, there's going to be nothing but major things coming. But there's a couple of movies that are coming out this week, and as I rattle them through, if you guys have something that you want to weigh in on them, whether you just, it's more like a recommend, don't recommend, whether people should go see this. Mowgli is Legend of the Jungle is reaching Netflix. People can actually start watching it on Netflix on December 7th, on this coming Friday. I think it's going to be in a few theaters. Natalie Portman is in Vox Lux. Julia Roberts is in Ben is Back. And then Mary Queen of Scots is doing its limited release. I think you guys have seen pretty much all of those, or most of them at least. Kevin's done.
I've seen three. I have not seen Vox Lux, but I've seen the other three.
All right. I can talk to Vox Lux if you want to. It's not good. It's not good.
My favorite Sean like quote from his review is, Natalie Portman lost a bet.
She plays a... I will just say that she becomes a pop sensation, a Kesha-esque pop sensation. But the thing that triggers her to become this massive global pop star is a school shooting that she was like one of the lone survivors of. So it was a really weird movie in the first place, because you endure this really difficult school shooting scene at the beginning of the movie, and you wonder, like, where does that go? And it turns out that this girl who was a survivor of it took all of her pain and suffering from surviving this and channeled them into pop music. But then she just becomes like an ugly person. Like, she's really horrible to people, and she's totally insensitive to people. And it was a really odd project, and I don't necessarily know the point of it. And it just left me feeling really, really cold. So I don't know. That's coming into theaters this week. Kevin, tell me about Mowgli. Like, I've heard it's really dark and disturbing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a darker telling, for sure. This is Andy Serkis's version. I feel bad for Andy Serkis in the sense of, like, what happened with... Because that was such an interesting thing, because obviously Jon Favreau made his Jungle Book movie. Andy Serkis was developing his film as well. And, you know, I believe Warner Bros. Was supposed to originally release Mowgli, right?
They were, yeah.
And, you know, obviously, you know, thankfully to Netflix, they came in and kind of saved the film and brought it over, so now it'll get a proper release, which, by the way, I saw a statistic yesterday that blew my mind, and I don't want to say the wrong number, but that Christmas movie that Kurt Russell's starring in
Christmas
right now
Chronicles.
On Netflix,
yeah,
has been viewed by 20 million people since its release.
I'm one of them. Actually, we watch it as a family.
So I looked at that number, and I'm like, oh my god, this is. And so now I'm going back to Mowgli. I'm like, this was a win for Andy Serkis. Now it's like, it's because had that come out in theaters, I don't think it would have done well, because everyone was going to be like, oh, this is that we already had a Jungle Book 3 movie 3 years ago. So I think this was a great move on. So I get the reason I feel bad is I wish people could see it on the big screen, because I know Andy worked really hard to get the performance capture and the visuals. But, you know, kudos to Netflix for giving it a proper release, and they're still giving him some select theaters in certain areas throughout the country. Performance, I mean, the guy is a brilliant performance capture artist, so that's really why this movie works well, is because, you know, Christian Bale's doing performance capture, Serkis is playing Baloo through performance capture. It's much darker, it's not a kid's movie. There are actual stakes, there's real violence, there is death. This is not Favreau's Jungle Book. So the movie itself, yeah, I mean, I think people are going to be, that dark element of it, I think, is going to surprise people. I think people are going to be shocked at the darkness it goes. I wouldn't call it R-rated. I think it's more PG-13. But, you know, listen, it's Andy Serkis. The guy, I thought Breathe was actually very well done. I think he's a good storyteller. And I'm interested to see what people think about it. Cate Blanchett's great in it. Bale's great in it. There's some great casting. Benedict Cumberbatch as Shere Khan, I believe. He was great. You know, so I recommend people watch on Netflix or see it in the theater if you can. But it is very different from Favreau's movie, for sure.
Jake, would you recommend Ben is Back?
I would not.
I'm with you.
It feels like two different films that don't add up to something that is worth recommending. The first part is, a fairly decent sort of, unfortunately, sort of a very similar take as what we're getting with Beautiful Boy, where a mother is dealing with the fact that her son unexpectedly returns home from rehab. Whether he was given permission or not is unclear at the beginning, given permission to actually leave rehab. He shows up. The mother seems very naive, yet also aware of who her son is because she's hiding jewelry. She's hiding, you know, prescription medicines. And then, so that's the first half of the movie. And I was sort of into it. And I love Julia Roberts. And any excuse where she's giving a good performance, she never really gives a bad performance, but she seems to be giving a particularly good performance in this film. So I was digging it for a while. I like Lucas Hedges. He's a good actor, obviously. He's in just about everything these days. And then the second half of the film, and correct me if I'm wrong, the second half of the film is essentially about the two of them in the car looking for a lost dog. And yes, it does act as a catalyst for other things that are going on, and it does launch him into a few other things. But it is fair to say that the second half of the movie is Lucas Hedges and Julia Roberts in a car looking for a dog.
But the dog going missing, here's the thing. So I think, and I mean this with the utmost respect, I think it's a bit of an oversimplification of what that is. I think the dog, I don't know if this is spoilery to say, but can I say why the dog goes missing, or is that too spoilery?
No, okay. All right. Anyway.
All right, never mind. We'll move on.
Okay, here's
we'll
the deal. It should have affected me more. I don't know. I say skip it.
I thought the dog was a good tool.
I agree with Kevin's bit that, yeah, the dog means more in the grand scheme of the movie.
Just the dog missing, yeah.
But they lean on it a little bit too hard.
Yeah.
So
One thing I will say, by the way, Peter Hedges directed that movie. And when I saw him in New York on Sunday for the interviews, this is fascinating to me. If you look at the majority of Peter Hedges' films, most of them have a person's name in the title. What's Eating Gilbert Grape, Dan in Real Life, Ben is Back, Pieces of April, The Odd Life of Timothy Green. So I asked him, I was like, why do you do that? He goes, well, what's funny is my next movie also has a name in it. It's because he finds that putting the person's name in the writing or the title helps him center the story more. It's like a mental thing.
Did you say Dan in Real Life too? He wrote Dan in Real Life.
Yeah. And Lucas Hedges is actually in that movie, has a small role.
I just thought that Ben is Back was a little bit long, and so someone needed to trim the hedges a little bit. I want Kevin to talk about Christmas.
Oh, that was great. Thank you, Sean.
Kevin had an opportunity to see a film that I'm super curious about, but I don't know if he can talk about it yet. You saw Once Upon a Deadpool. Can you talk about it?
I don't know that I'm under any kind of embargo. I mean, I mean, here's the thing. I guess I won't give my official review, but I'll tell you what it is. I mean,
the hell is this movie? What is it?
Well, so I actually went back and watched The Princess Bride over the week yesterday before my interviews. If you can imagine The Princess Bride, it's the same thing. So basically, if you remember Princess Bride, Fred Savage's room as a kid, right? His grandfather's reading him that book and then takes us through the story of The Princess Bride with Cary Elwes and Robin Wright. Yeah. So this is the same. It's the same thing. I mean, the trailers show you that too, but very, very similar. They just throw Deadpool 2. It just happens to be the story he's telling.
Much of the actual Deadpool 2 movie is in it? Like 80%?
So, yeah, it's the majority of the film. But on top of that, the cool thing about Deadpool is that because he's under a mask, there's a lot of alt jokes. Yeah. So you're getting different versions of the jokes than you saw in the film at times. There's also different scenes. I mean, the trailers show you this. Jake's remember the trailers? Sold. I know, Jake's not sold. But in the trailers, you saw the up moment. I mean, by the way, so that joke at the end of the trailer where Fred Savage is joking about Fox and Marvel, that goes more extreme than that. It's actually really funny. But yeah, I mean, if you like Deadpool 2... it's basically Deadpool 2 a bit filtered, but in kind of a funny way.
Do they do beeps? Do they beep out curses?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. There's all beeps. Right. You'll see. I mean, it is exactly what you would think Ryan Reynolds would do with a PG-13 version of Deadpool. So
okay, but let me ask you. If I only thought Deadpool 2 was okay, is there any point in me seeing this movie?
No. I mean, but I love Deadpool 2, and a lot of people did. So it's basically like you rewatching Deadpool 2 with about 10 to 15, maybe more minutes. I don't want to give
There's
an exact
more
number
of it.
No. I'm talking about the Fred Savage element. I'm talking about the they alter some scenes. But I don't want to say much because I don't know what I can say yet. But I will say that the film, if you're a Deadpool 2 fan, it's the movie you saw with a bit of a different spin. That's kind of all I can say. But I mean, I enjoyed it as a Deadpool fan. That's all I will say. So if you're a Deadpool 2 fan, there's no reason you won't like it.
Okay. I want to get to a spoiler-free review of Into the Spider-Verse. And it sounds like we're doing it early, but the embargo has lifted. We can talk freely about this. Review embargo is lifted. Next week, by the time we get to go, the Aquaman review will have lifted. So I want to save that for next week. So Spider-Verse doesn't open until December 14th, but... Oh, Jake, you haven't seen it. Oh, shoot.
No, so this is fun for me.
Sorry. Sorry, Jake. Kevin, let's do it briefly, and then we'll get to Eastwood Blend. There's a lot of hype around Into the Spider-Verse, and I went into it with expectations through the roof, and I'll just say that it topped them. This is actually, I put this on social media, too. This is my number two movie of the year, and my number one is Infinity War, and this is my number two movie of the year. And it bothers me a little bit that my two movies... for 2018 currently are superhero movies. And I don't know what I'm going to see between now and the end of this year that will shake that up. But they're the two movies that emotionally moved me the most. And of course, that's just because of my connection to the characters in the Marvel universe. And especially Spider-Man and Spider-Man. This is such an incredible Spider-Man story. And the funny thing about it is that it's mostly Miles Morales' story. And I didn't grow up reading Miles Morales. I read Peter Parker, but it gets the all the beats of somebody who gets the Spider-Man powers, what they have to go through, what they have to sacrifice, how they shoulder this load, how quite often they don't want to shoulder the load. It focuses on villains that we haven't seen on screen before and gives them all the justification for why they should be there. The introduction of the multiverse, which if anyone's paid attention to the trailers for it, you know that there's something that happens that triggers multiple versions of Spider-Man to come to Miles' world. And they basically teach him how to be Spider-Man. And they're drastically different from, like, there's an overweight Peter Parker who has his own sort of emotional issues. But then there's Spider-Man Noir, who's voiced by Nicolas Cage, who's from the 1930s. There's Spider-Gwen. There's Spider-Ham, which is a pig in a Spider-Man suit. And it's by Lord and Miller. And a friend of mine, when they came out of it, they were like, you know, look, I'm a huge Star Wars guy and I love Solo and I was not on this bandwagon before this, but now I want to see what Lord Miller would have done with Solo. Like, they're so smart and they're so, they just understand their material so well. And there's a moment in this movie, this isn't a spoiler. We knew that Stan Lee had a cameo in it. The Stan Lee cameo in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is the moment in the film when I started crying and then I cried through pretty much the rest of it. It's fantastic. I've given it 5 stars out of 5, second best movie of the year for me. And it floored me on every level.
Yeah, and it's important to say that Sean is one of the biggest Spider-Man fans I've ever met in my life. So you have to take what he said very seriously because he's very close to the character. And that is probably the truest review you're going to get of that film in the sense of what a Spider-Man fan would expect from this movie. I come from a perspective of somebody who did not read the Spider-Man comics obsessively as a kid. So we've had this debate on the show before. My favorite Spider-Man movie of all time is Spider-Man 2, Sam Raimi's film. And Sean has had issues with that. That being said, I'm with Sean on this. To me, it's for my rankings, it's right there with Spider-Man 2. So it's my tied for my favorite Spider-Man film at the moment. Lord and Miller are, for lack of a better term, geniuses. I mean, these guys are so in tune with what fans love and know about characters, but making them feel different and special. You know, 21 Jump Street was a great example of that. I mean, they really kind of turned that into their own thing. Spider-Man, yeah, to me, this movie was revolutionary from an animation standpoint. I was talking to Lord and Miller about the way the animation was done. You're dealing with hand-drawn animation, matte paintings. The entire film pops like a comic book. And there are literally lines through every frame of this movie as if you're reading a page. So to me, that's what popped the most. On top of that, this incredible character arc that Miles goes through, Shameik Moore is brilliant as Miles Morales. Everyone in this film, from a voice perspective, there's a lot of surprises too, which we won't get into. But also Nick Cage, and this is not a spoiler, who plays Spider-Man Noir, like who, there's just so many like cool little things. And here's the thing. This could have gone badly because of how much is happening. There is so much going on in this movie. But like Infinity War, they pace it well. They keep it succinct. They keep it interesting. But to me, the best thing this movie does is that it simultaneously has a very important message about diversity representation, but also always keeps you entertained. It never feels like they're trying to hit you with a message. And that to me is a really hard thing to do as a filmmaker. But the Stan Lee cameo that Sean's referring to, I had spoken to Lord and Miller about that because the movie, obviously Steve Ditko and Stan Lee have both passed away this year, I believe. Ditko passed away this year as well, right, Sean? Am I wrong on that? Okay. But he has passed away.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot weighing on this movie about those two guys, those two heavyweights gone.
Yep.
That scene is pretty incredible. I asked Phil Lord about what the art is to writing a Stan Lee cameo because, you know, the Stan Lee cameo has become such a staple in these Marvel films. He gave a great answer to it. He actually revealed what the cameo was in my interview, which I won't say here, but I'll put it up online. I don't think it's too much of a spoiler, but we can get into that later.
Well, what I'll say is it's not that they lucked out, but like, what happens in the scene could have just been a normal scene, but because we lost Stan, the scene without changing takes on a whole other significance, and it works in the film's benefit that way.
Yeah, and it's really well done. And I actually asked Shameik if he got to record that scene with Stan Lee, and he said he didn't get to record it with them because it's always interesting how the Stan Lee cameo works because like he's probably there for a day, right? He comes in real quick, does his shot. I always love the one.
A lot of his cameos, he records like multiple cameos in one day.
Really? Yeah. I always love the Homecoming one. That one's great. But there's so many. Actually, no, my favorite's probably the Infinity War on the bus. But we'll get to that later. But there's so many. The movie's very special. It feels special. And I'll tell you this, and I kind of believe in these occurrences in life. I thought this was kind of interesting. I was driving to see Spider-Man with my wife, and there's a song that's used in the movie by Post Malone called Sun. I can't remember the name of it. It's the song that Shameik is kind of singing with his headphones. It's a Post Malone song. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to remember the name of it off the top of my Sunflower, I think, or something like that. I was on the way to the movie, and the Post Malone song came on my radio, and I had never heard it before. And I'm like, oh, I guess I didn't know Post Malone had a new song out. So I park my car, I get into the theater, I go upstairs, I sit down in my seat, and 10 minutes into the film, the song comes on.
Yeah.
And it was like this like very strange chain of events, and the song is now positioned as a song on the soundtrack. It's actually, I think it just kind of happily became part of the movie. So that becomes kind of a through line in the film as well. So yeah, I mean, the animation in this movie is just stunning. I've never seen anything look like this ever. It looks so cool. It's so well done.
Jake, do you know when you're going to get to see it?
I don't know. Every time they've screened it in Chicago, I've either been traveling or they screened it again last night. I was moderating the Q&A with Barry Jenkins. So I might be one of those people that just has to go buy a ticket opening weekend, which based on the quality of the film, I'm more than happy to do.
These all sound like excuses to me, Jake. And I think you're just actively not trying to see this movie.
Yeah.
So we get it.
I don't know why you hate the movie.
It's
a good movie, Jake.
We already know you hated Roma, but I didn't know you were already actively hating this one. I mean, come on.
All right, I'm 5 out of 5.
The fury that is building up inside of me right now. And I don't want to scream out what I'm thinking because this is
Kevin,
a family-friendly podcast.
What star rating are you at, BDK?
Oh, for Spider-Man? Yeah. I'm gonna hold off on my official rating until the review day, because I don't know if I'm allowed to say that yet.
Okay.
Am I allowed to? I think we're under embargo. I loved it. I mean, I love the movie. Don't get me wrong. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that.
You might be under a different one.
I think we have weird embargoes here in DC.
Yeah. All right, this week's blend game.
I don't even want to know if I want to play.
Without even... Gabe's happy. We'll wrap the show up quicker. we picked Eastwood Blend without actually knowing that we were going to get a chance to go and interview Clint Eastwood. So maybe we'll add something to it after we see The Mule. But we're playing Eastwood Blend. It is the favorite films of Clint Eastwood. We loosened the rules of the game this week so that we could do anything that he potentially directed or starred in or did both or was just involved in some way, shape, or form. So, Kevin, I've been told that you get to go first.
So this is really strange. So the film that I picked is because of a very specific scene. And as we were starting the show, I went back to find the exact dialogue to the scene. So I want to make sure I had the numbers right for the dialogue that he says. And I just realized that the scene itself has an animal in it that is now titled of the new movie that we're interviewing him for, which is The Mule. So now I'm like, I have to bring this up to him when I interview him. Do you guys know what I'm referring to yet or no?
No.
Okay.
What movie is he in with a mule?
All right. So my ultimate favorite scene ever with Clint Eastwood is the reason why I chose Fistful of Dollars.
Okay.
And there's a scene in Fistful of Dollars where he is riding into town and he tells the coffin maker to prepare three coffins for him because he was foreshadowing. He's about to mess some people up, right? Yeah. I mean, like in Clint Eastwood style.
Sure.
And so the scene then proceeds, and there's like a group of guys laughing at Clint Eastwood's mule. He calls it a mule. I always thought it was a horse. That's why I was reading the dialogue again. But he goes, "Hey, my mule doesn't appreciate you laughing at him. I need you to apologize to him. Can you please apologize?" I mean, these guys are like hard. Like criminals that he's referring to. Like, can you please apologize for laughing at my mule? And they refuse to apologize. So he just blows them all away. I mean, it's like Clint Eastwood style. And then when he rides back away, and by the way, it's the subtlety of how he says it. You know, my mule doesn't appreciate you laughing at him. Can you apologize to him? I mean, it's so beautiful. Watch the scene if you haven't seen it. And Sergio Leone, obviously, this is the Man with the No Name trilogy. I mean, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is probably my favorite film of the trilogy. But this scene alone, hands down, my favorite thing Clint Eastwood ever did. And so remember, I told you he told the guy to prepare three coffins. So he ends up killing four guys. So he ends up taking back off to leave the town, and he goes, "Oh, my mistake, prepare four." And he was just like, I don't know, I just love the way he executed that scene and just the way it shot. I mean, Leone with his extreme close-ups on his eyes. I don't know, that when I think of Clint Eastwood, that is the ultimate scene that I go to. I remember talking to him, I interviewed him, the first time I ever interviewed him was J. Edgar. It was a red carpet in D.C., and I think I had gotten back to the station and I was showing people that scene over and over again. But just look it up on YouTube. It's Fistful of Dollars. Just type in like mule scene or type in coffin scene. Coffin's probably the word that'll help it come up. But now that I'm thinking about it and I'm interviewing him for a movie called The Mule, which I know is not, I mean, it's playing a drug mule. It's a different type of mule. But I gotta bring that up.
You have to bring it up.
I have to bring that up. That
Kevin
scene
is gonna use 2.5 minutes of his 4 minutes setting up like the connection and trying to over-explain how he understands that they're different kinds of mules.
I mean, Clint's response: "It's not that kind of mule."
Yeah. Oh my God! At some point in the movie, if he says something along the lines of "prepare three coffins," just as a throwback, which I don't think he'll do, right. It's gonna be my number one of the year. I mean, it's gonna be amazing.
Not but, the film, just his own interview.
Just that
will
scene.
Be.
But listen, I know that's a very obscure thing to bring up, but I was just thinking about that, and that's my favorite moment he's ever had in a movie. So that just by default becomes my favorite Clint Eastwood performance. But again, I mean, listen, the guy has done a zillion things and there's a million things to choose from. That's just my personal connection.
That's the point of the game. That's the beauty of the blend game is we pick favorites and have really weird reasons why we choose them. Right. So let's get to Jake's. Jakey, you're next.
If you remember last week was Stallone blend and I chose Creed because I said that it portrayed one of my all-time favorite cinematic characters as a very human, broken person and proof that our heroes have the ability to age and weather down and potentially get sick and get cancer. And that sort of also sort of applies to why I chose my favorite Clint Eastwood movie as Unforgiven. Because we grew up with, a lot of people grew up with Clint Eastwood being the man with no name, being Blondie, Dirty Harry, whatever the case may be, just this almost impenetrable sort of cinematic hero that was always going to ride away into the dust, and we were always going to sort of wonder what happened to this guy, and he was always just this unbelievable badass. And when we meet him at the beginning of Unforgiven, he's given up that life. He's broken down because his wife has been killed. He's literally falling down in, like, pig crap because he's trying to wrestle around with the pigs to try to, you know, and it's this version of a guy who's kind of also looking to get back into his glory, and it really is such an interesting reflection and really an unglamorous version of what happens to these kind of characters that he spent his entire life playing. And if he wanted to, could have kept playing those people as long as he wanted to, but he took it upon himself to say, hey, things don't always work out as well for these guys as you think they're going to. And I rewatched that film recently because we knew we were going to get it, Clint, and I really specifically wanted to rewatch that one. And it's just such an amazing, not just with Clint, because I know we were also able to pick based on work he did behind the camera, and obviously he directed Unforgiven, and it's such, I think it's his best directorial effort. I think it's his most assured effort as a director. I mean, I think that is one of my all-time favorite Westerns ever. I mean, you get a killer performance from Gene Hackman, for which he won an Oscar, an amazing performance from Morgan Freeman. Just really, it's just both his work in front of and behind the camera, what he's able to say about, in my opinion, his own legacy and the characters that he spent his entire career playing, and almost not spit in the face of them, but say, hey, they're not as ongoingly cool as you think they're going to be, I think says a lot about him as a storyteller. So that's why I choose Unforgiven.
Which is interesting, because that's exactly, like, it's funny that everything Jake just said is great, because that's literally what Unforgiven was that aspect of that character in a more realistic, grounded level.
Right.
So that
it's almost like A Few Dollars More once he's 70 years old.
Exactly. And that's kind of, it's interesting that we both found that route, but different sides of it, because I loved that over the top, just like nobody can touch me. I you know, that character that we had in The Man with No Name in the Leone film. So yeah, it's funny though, because Unforgiven really is that more grounded, realistic version of who that person would end up becoming. I always just liked the way he would just deliver his lines in like the Dirty Harry films, or just the untouchableness of that type.
I mean,
of
you
person.
Really can't have an appreciation for one without the other. I don't think you can appreciate Unforgiven without the Sergio Leone trilogy. And obviously, I think the Sergio Leone trilogy is made better by sort of in theory thinking that what happens to this guy is what is him in Unforgiven.
Can I ask a stupid question? All my life I've said Leone. Is that not right?
Leone? Sergio Leone?
I think it's
Sergio Leone.
Leone? Sergio Leone.
Well, my apologies. I apologize for my mistake. I made a mistakey. I always thought it was Leone because there's an E at the end.
I get to go next, and I just want to, before I give my choice, point out that Clint Eastwood doesn't get enough credit for the fact that he made two movies where his co-star was an orangutan. Every which way you can.
I was wondering, it's any which way but loose. If anyone was going to joke.
I mean, those are legitimately two movies that he made that are just like redneck soap operas where his co-star is an orangutan. Like, I mean, imagine if we were journalists back in the day covering those movies, we'd be writing infinite stories about Clint and his orangutan. They're fantastic films. If you haven't seen them, please look them up. I wanted to pick an Eastwood film where he was a director also, because I think that's such a significant part of his career. And the thing about Eastwood as a director that is fascinating to me is that because he's made some amazing, amazing films, he gets, and because he's Clint, he gets the instant credibility that, like, when you know that there's an Eastwood movie coming, you automatically, you put it on a pedestal and you wait to be potentially proven wrong, right? And every once in a while, he proves you wrong. He gives you like a couple of body blows, but they're not great movies. It's like Flags of Our Father, Changeling, Invictus. They're movies where like there's good things going on in them, but you would never be like, that's a great movie. You know, like, I'm going to put that movie on now, Hereafter. You know, like there's a bunch of movies in here where you're like, oh, the new Clint. And then it turns out to be like True Crime, you know, or Blood Work or something like that. And you're like, all right, that wasn't a Clint. But then when he delivers a haymaker, you're just like, whoa, what? That was incredible. This is Clint. How come Clint can't do this all the time? And the one that floored me the most that I'll always go back to as my favorite work of his is Million Dollar Baby. Wow. Million Dollar Baby is so incredible for this reason. It is an awesome boxing movie for most of its run, right? It's this grizzled trainer who doesn't want to train this girl. Hilary Swank is so great as the spunky, you know, just, I'm not going to go away, so you might as well start training me. Morgan Freeman's terrific as the counterpart to Clint, the two grumpy old men sort of, and then he finally sees something inside this girl that he's going to train her and bring her up, and they rise the ranks, and it could have been a Rocky movie, right? And then, and spoiler alert if you haven't seen Million Dollar Baby, but turn this podcast off right now and go away, that movie changes gears and takes a hard left turn when she becomes injured. And it becomes this quadriplegic story and this girl in the hospital bed and the father figure who's grown to love her. And in anyone else's hands, that movie probably falls flat on its face. And you just don't believe, you know, either of the storylines. And you sort of question, like, what the heck happened? But this, the back half of Million Dollar Baby devastated me because Clint handled the material so wonderfully. And I don't think he's always the most subtle director, but I thought he just perfectly balanced the two materials between the relationships that were so pivotal to the beginning of Million Dollar Baby to make it a really riveting up through the ranks sports movie to then change gears and become this amazing talk about what do you do when somebody who you love is hurt beyond compare and isn't going to be able to bounce back. Do you pull the plug? And tremendous, tremendous, tremendous movie that deserved every accolade that it got that year. And I think it caught most people by surprise. And that, I think, is the movie that people circle and they're like, yeah, but do you remember when he came back with Million Dollar Baby and it swept the Oscars? And every time he has a new one coming, we're always like, maybe this is the one. And it's quite often not. Quite often it's like J. Edgar. But Million Dollar Baby, to me, blew me away.
I respect your passion in that film. I didn't love Million Dollar Baby. I don't know how Jay felt about it. I felt it to be very manipulative. I think... performance-wise, there's some great storytelling in there. I remember liking it a lot and then revisiting it and just feeling very manipulated. Like, I feel like there are times where you can feel like a filmmaker is just trying to make you feel bad or and I think it subtlety in that aspect, yeah, I thought it was a bit overdone. Now, I mean, it's interesting because, like, directing-wise, my favorite movie he ever directed is Mystic River. So I always kind of go back to that one. I think Million Dollar Baby is very good. Jake, are you in love with that movie? I honestly
have not seen it since it came out in theaters, and which was what, 14, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
And I mean, and that, if that math is correct, I would have been 14 or 15 years old. So it needs a revisit before I can definitively say what I think about it.
And I'm in no way diminishing anything you just said, Sean. I'm just reacting to that film in general because, I mean, the beauty of what we all do is that we are all touched by different types of movies for different ways. And, you know, you don't love Forrest Gump. I love Forrest Gump. I mean, regardless of what I say, I respect every word you just said. And I'm like, and you're actually making me want to revisit it. I mean, here's the thing. I could pop Million Dollar Baby on tomorrow and it could end and I could go, oh my God, that's one of the best movies I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it's possible that at the point in my life when I saw it, maybe I was in a weird emotional spot. I have no clue where I was emotionally when I first saw that movie. So I kind of, after what you just said, want to revisit it solely based on your high praise to see if I maybe missed something.
Sweet. I know at the time you told me you wanted it to Hillary tank.
Yeah. See, there we go. Yeah, I'm really, I actually do want to ask Clint Eastwood on Sunday.
Kalina, if you're listening, my job is available.
I do wonder, though. Well, do you think Clint Eastwood uses Sprint Eastwood, like, even so he can get good, like, cell service? I do wonder that.
I sure hope so.
I mean, we could ask him on Sunday because I would love to know if. And also,
why are you here if you can't end this,
Kevin? He would answer Million Dollar Maybe.
Ah, yeah. And then, you know, sometimes when I go into interviews, I have some, you know, I have some spots on my suit from my hair. So maybe I can get a lint roller Eastwood. Yeah. To get it off when I go
Clint
to
roller?
The,
All right. Audience picks. Christine Swordsky says Gran Torino. Travis Smith chose Heartbreak Ridge. Mac Rowden says Unforgiven. So agrees with Jake. And Matt Cook says two of them, favorite directed, Unforgiven, favorite overall, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which I think is really cool.
Do you think his favorite movie?
I don't know if this is a hot take, but I hate Gran Torino.
I love Gran Torino.
Actively hated it. Oh, I hate that movie.
What do you like? What do you dislike more, Jake? Gran Torino or Fantastic Beastwood? Come on.
Next week's game, as we're fast approaching episode number 50, is going to be a broader one. We're opening up the floodgates, and you can go in any direction you want to go with this, but it's hashtag sequel blend. Suggested by Kevin McCarthy, floated on the show before, excuse me, but not necessarily dove into. I think it sort of came up when I brought up the Toy Story 2 as the greatest sequel ever created and got shouted down. Rightfully so, I was wrong. So yes, it's sequel blend. And again, what's going to make sequel blend the most fun is that we're not arguing what is the best of all time. We're talking about what is our favorite of all time. And Kevin can't say T2. So that's the rule, unfortunately, yes.
Jake, I think one of us, and this is not my joke, I can't take credit for this, one of us needs to say to do the Christian Bale joke to Christian Bale on Sunday. Like, you know, what do you call it when Batman skips church? Christian Bale. I think someone needs to say that right
to him. I'll tell you what. I'm going to leave that to you, but I want to do my interview first. So let me go in first, and then you go in there and you drop that BS.
But, I mean, we do need to tell him about, this is such a great year for screeners. We've been getting so much Christian mail about, like, all, you know, all these screeners that are coming in.
Gabe really wants us to bail out of this conversation.
Do you think that when he lost the weight after playing Vice, he had to eat a lot of Christian kale?
Reach out on Twitter using hashtag sequel.
In the show, he will keep going.
His favorite Tom Hanks movie is Christian You've Got Mail.
your pick via email at realblend@cinemablend.com. Obviously, on social media, you can find at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, or at Sean_O'Connell. Go over to the iTunes page, please. Leave us a star rating. We're still trying to get to 100. We don't want to Christian fail in our mission to get there. If you leave us a review, we'll read it at the top of next week's episode.
Did you ever notice that Christian loves that movie, Jackie Brown, because Robert Forster played a Christian Balesman?
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to episode number 47 of Real Blend. We love you guys for following. We will talk to you next week. Goodbye, all.
Wait. Solo. Dunkirk. And also, I wonder what Christian's favorite ale. I was going to do an ale joke, like a beer joke.
Please leave that in, Gabe. Please leave that in.
Dunkirk.